Hello. We've all got our Bibles. So what chapter of Acts are we up to? Anyone? 16? 25? 14. Beautiful. Alright, so where did we leave off last time? Where was St. Paul in his journey last time? You can look it up. Previous chapter. Where was he? Cyprus. Was he? Yeah, so he might have started off there. But then where did he end up? He travelled to one of the two Antiochs. Not Syrian Antioch, one of the other Antiochs, which is Pisidian Antioch. And so when he's there, again, he has more issues, more contentions. And then they say they shook off the dust in verse 51. They shook off the dust from their feet against them, and they came to Iconium. Okay, so he's just finished. He's just finished preaching in Pisidian Antioch. They've been rejected there to some degree. And now he's moved off, and he's gone to Iconium. All right, so that's the context. Because we have to keep an eye in mind, you're reading a story here, okay? Which is why reading Acts chapter by chapter is a little bit challenging. So if you're in your home and you're reading, I do recommend that you read it successively, all right? Try to read 3-4 chapters at a time. It'll make much more sense to you. So then he comes to Iconium. So read the first 4 verses. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, God, amen. Now it happened in Iconium that they went together to the synagogue of the Jews, and so spoke that a great multitude both of the Jews and of the Greeks believed. But the unbelieving Jews stirred up the Gentiles and poisoned their minds against the brethren. Therefore they stayed there a long time, speaking boldly in the Lord, who was bearing witness to the word of his grace, granting signs and wonders to be done by their hands. But the multitude of the city was divided. Part sided with the Jews and part with the apostles. So he's preaching at Iconium. He's moved from Pisidian Antioch to there with Barnabas. Iconium, does anyone have any idea where that is? It's a place in central Turkey, central Anatolia, in Turkey, called Konya. That's the modern place where it is. So he's in Turkey. And he's preaching to these Jews at the synagogues and the Greeks as well. Now we saw last time, where are these Gentiles, where are these non-Jews coming from? How are they coming into the picture if he's preaching the synagogues? Does anyone remember what I said last time? They were God-fearers. They were God-fearers. So they're Greeks or Gentiles in some degree who believe in the Jewish faith, but haven't actually taken that step where they become an actual Jew. And so, likely they wouldn't get their friends, or the Jews wouldn't have got their friends. And so all these people started listening to St. Paul. And he starts to have some measure of success before, again, the unbelieving Jews stirred up the Gentiles and poisoned their minds against the brethren. Now you have to remember, just to keep it, I keep saying this to make it clear, these unbelieving Jews are not Jews that are against Christianity. They're Jews against other Jews. But those other Jews that they're against are Jews that believe that the Messiah has come. All right. But the way that St. Luke talks about this, you almost get this idea that the Jews are always bad and the Christians are always good. It doesn't work like that. Most of the Christians were Jews, okay? They were just Jews that had their faith reconfigured in the light of Christ. And then we get to verse 3. Therefore, but the unbelieving Jews stirred up the Gentiles and poisoned their minds against the brethren. Therefore, they stayed there a long time. Does that make sense when you read? I come to St. Mark's. I'm objected. I'm rejected. People swear at me. People tell me to get out. Therefore, I stay inside and talk. Does that make sense? Doesn't make much logical sense. All right. But in the logic of St. Paul, in the logic of St. Luke, it makes a lot of sense. Okay. Just because they were being attacked in terms of verbal abuse, in terms of rejection, was not enough for them to leave the city. St. John Chrysostom says, because they had not been physically persecuted at this point, if they get slandered, if they get sworn at, if they get spat at, they don't care. It just makes them more bold. And so therefore they stayed there a long time, speaking boldly in the Lord, who is bearing witness to the words of his grace, the word of his grace, granting signs and wonders to be done by their hands. So miracles are now starting to happen at the hands of St. Paul and St. Barnabas. Okay? And these miracles were very, very convicting. These miracles had a lot of power, a lot of authority. But look at the next sentence. But the multitude of the city was divided. So what's the effect of the miracle? Does it convince everybody? It divides. It sets us in the camp that we're supposed to be in. It sets us in the camp that we have decided to be in. The miracle sits there and acts in a way that it forces me to get off the fence. I can't sit with one leg on one side and another leg on the other side. The miracle forces me. Where will I be? Where will I be? Sometimes we think that miracles and signs and these kind of things, that will convince everybody. If only there was a vision, everybody would repent. If only there was a vision, everybody would turn to Christ. But that's actually not the case. It's actually not the case. What miracles and signs do, they reinforce and confirm my predisposition. They confirm me in the path that I want. If I am somebody that has a little bit of faith, that is moving towards Christ, that thinks maybe he could be the Messiah, and I want that, and I'm moving to that, and I'm seeking the truth, and then a miracle comes, what does it do? It pushes me into the believer's camp. Okay? It acts to confirm me, to consolidate my position. But if I'm that person that is a skeptic and is looking for any excuse to get out of faith, is looking for any excuse to turn away from God, is looking for any excuse to turn to my selfish ambitions, my selfish desires, then when that miracle comes, it'll divide me, it'll push me, it'll polarize. Something we can't understand, but something that actually happens in human history. For instance, the parable of Lazarus. Do you guys remember that parable that Jesus said? There was a poor man, Lazarus, sitting by the gate of a rich man. And he was so poor and he was so helpless that the dogs came and licked his sores. And he was sitting in this pile almost of his dead skin and dogs licking him. Because he was in so much pain and in so much suffering that his skin was open and broken. He dies. The rich man that is living inside the house, in the mansion, also dies. The rich man goes where? Goes where? To Hades. Goes to Gehenna. Alright? Goes to a place which is not very comfortable, not very pleasant. Lazarus goes where? Into the bosom of Abraham. Okay? When he's there, the rich man looks up at Lazarus and says, actually doesn't even look at Lazarus. He looks at Abraham, and which shows him that he still is thinking in this idea that I'm a rich man and control the world. He says to Abraham, send Lazarus for me so that he can put his finger into the water and just touch it in my mouth to give me a bit of comfort. He says, sorry, I can't. Even if he wanted to, the gap between where you are and between where he is, it's impossible to cross. He says, all right, send Lazarus so that he may go to my brothers and may convince them that they should not come to this place. I.e. you, as somebody who is beyond the earth, beyond this world, go back to them, give them a vision, tell them, guys, your brother is in hell, do not end up like him. Does anyone remember what is the response? Sorry, say that louder. If they did not listen to Moses and the prophets, they will not listen to Lazarus. If they did not listen to the scriptures, even if a miracle happens from the dead, even if Lazarus comes back from the dead, it won't make a difference. And we sit there going, no, I think it would. But would Christ lie? Has Christ got it wrong? In 1968, St. Mary appeared to millions. Not millions, a million. Hundreds of thousands of people. Including the Muslim president himself, including countless number of Muslims, including countless number of Christians. How many of them do you think repented? Truly repented. Long-standing repentance. I would suspect, I mean, we can never tell, but I would suspect the number would be far, far, far less than you can imagine. Does it make sense? Does it make sense? If having a miracle, if having a vision was enough to convince us, God would even give it to us. But he knows it's not enough. Adam and Eve walked in the garden, talked with God, felt his presence so directly yet they still fell. They still fell. Why? Why? Because it's not the end all. Having the vision is not something that is automatically going to change something. It's not something that's automatically going to make things good. What it does is it polarizes. Where do I want to be? Where is my heart longing for? It's the same argument, for example, what is heaven, what is hell? What is heaven, what is hell? It's the same thing. Death polarizes. It confirms. It consolidates. It kind of says, all right, you want heaven? I will soften your heart towards heaven. You want hell? I will harden your heart towards hell. It's simply God saying, I'll let you be where you want to be. So we have to think of this as we look at the miracles, that there is something beyond what we think so easily in our minds. Then we come to verses 5 to 7. And when a violent attempt was made by both the Gentiles and the Jews, with their rulers to abuse and stone them, they became aware of it and fled to Lystra and Derbe, cities of Lycaonia, and to the surrounding region. And they were all preaching the gospel there. So notice here now, who is persecuting them? When a violent attempt was made by the Gentiles and the Jews with their rulers. So you see here, the issue is no longer just the Jews. St. Paul has been talking. The Gentiles were convinced. The Jews came and poisoned them. St. Paul did miracles. And then there was a division. That division was not clean cut between Jews and Gentiles. There would have been Jews that were convinced. There would have been Gentiles that were convinced. There would be Jews that weren't convinced. And there would be Gentiles that weren't convinced. Okay. And that's exactly what St. Paul says in his other writings, in his other letters. He says, out of the ones that will be saved, you will find that there are some, there is a remnant of the Jews, and there'll be a part of the Gentiles. Not all Gentiles will be saved. Not all Jews will be rejected. And then they come and they disappear. They flee to Lystra and Derbe. Why didn't they stay to be martyred? They're apostles. Christ said to them, the servant is not greater than his master. If Christ died on the cross, why do they run? Why do they flee? Isn't it cowardly? Yeah, they had to fulfill what they wanted to do. What does Christ say when a city rejects you? What did Christ say to the apostles? Go to another city. Shake off the dust. Go to another city. Okay, go to a city. Why? Because the purpose of their preaching is not that they get martyred. Martyrdom will come. And it will come to St. Paul. But not now. The purpose of their preaching is to preach. Is to convert cities. Stoning was usually fatal. So they knew that was coming upon them. So they go. Not out of cowardice, but out of common sense. Because their time was not yet. Then they go to an area called Lycaonia. This was a part of the Galatian province. So that whole area is part of Galatia, South and North Galatia. It's all part of the Galatia province. But it seems to be that Lycaonia, the districts of Lycaonia, where Lystra and Derbe are, was a different political district. It was a different jurisdiction. So perhaps they felt that, okay, if we go there, the false charges that are being laid against us in Iconium, they're not going to follow us. And so they go. And then they come to verse 8. And in Lystra, a certain man without strength in his feet was sitting, a cripple from his mother's womb, who had never walked. This man heard Paul speaking. Paul, observing him intently and seeing that he had faith to be healed, said with a loud voice, "Stand up straight on your feet," and he leapt up and walked. So the man was a cripple from birth. Okay? Remember, this is not a city which has millions of people. These are villages. These are tight villages where everybody knows everyone. So if I'm sitting there, I've been a cripple since I was a baby. Okay? There's no chance I'm faking it. If when I was 12 years old, then I became a cripple, then I say, maybe he's faking it. He's putting his money out like in Egypt. Give me some money. All right? And then 2 seconds later, they walk off and get Maccas. All right? That's not what's happening here. He's a known cripple. All right? The man hears St. Paul speak. Do we hear that the man says anything? St. Paul turns, looks at him. The words used are gazed intently at him and sees that he has faith. How can you see that somebody has faith? Is it just because somebody's sitting there nice and humble? I don't know, please. Was that what he was seeing? St. John Chrysostom says he saw his soul. That's why it's very clear to say he observed him intently. He saw through him. He saw through him and knew that this man had something about him. He had something that was opening, an opening towards God. What did he see? What did he know? We don't know. But he saw that the man had an opening. The man had a door that was able to be pried open for Christ to enter. And he leaps up and walked. This reminds me of another story, but I can't remember if I said it to you guys. I talk a bit, so I can't remember what I say where. But did I tell you the guys the story of Amber Macarius and Pope Crawlers? Did I say that story? No? If I did, I'm sorry. Just pretend like I didn't say it before. He was saying, this is Amber Macarius was saying that when he was a young guy, so he was about 16, he would go and visit his brother in Cairo. And he goes, at the time, like he was a good guy, like he's got a church, but he wasn't really a very holy guy. Like he wasn't anything extraordinary. And he goes, when people would talk about miracles, I was a skeptic. I was like, unless I see it with my own eyes, I won't believe it. He goes, even if what happened to me, my brother told me, and I trust everything my brother says, even if he said it to me, I would have ignored him. He goes, one day, I was in the city in Cairo, went to visit my brother, and then I saw the Patriarch doors were open. I said, I'll go say hello try to get the blessing of the Pope, kiss his hand. Pope Crawlers, for those that don't know, was the Patriarch of the Coptic Church that died in 1971, a very holy man. He goes, so I walked in, and there was no guards, there's no nobody telling me what to do. So I walked up the stairs. As I walked up to the stairs, on the next level, no one was there, no one told me what to do. I go, oh, I'll walk up even further. I'll go to the Pope's private quarters. Because I walked up even further. He goes, then I was sitting there, there was about three or four people sitting there, and they were waiting to speak to the Pope. And they told me that the Pope is speaking to a metropolitan that was in trouble. Okay, because he'd been fighting with his congregations. There was a big, you know, intense conversation happening in the next room. And he goes, so I sat down there, and as I was sitting, I see these two people bringing up this woman on their arms, a woman that hadn't walked in the last 8 years, who had some kind of debilitating disease. I'm not sure what she had. And as they carried her up, they thought to herself, there's a lot of people here, and we might not get a chance, and the Pope's really busy. We'll put her at the door of the Pope's door, okay? So that when he leaves the room, he has to walk over her. So at the end of the meeting, the Pope opens the door. He doesn't even know what's going on. He just sees this lady there. He says, you, get up, Emshi, get up, get up. That's all he said. He goes, the young guy, 16, that would eventually become Amber Macarius, a bishop of the church. He goes, he saw the lady stand up and then just walk down the stairs. And he goes, I couldn't believe it. He goes, people weren't aware of what was happening. They just saw this lady lying there and get up. Like the Pope wasn't even aware. He just said, get up, and she moved. But I was sitting there. I saw them carrying her up two flights of stairs. He goes, and I would never have believed this unless I saw it with my own eyes. And I didn't believe it. The Pope walked off. I kissed his hand quickly. I ran after the woman. And I ran down the stairs. I said, what is this? A joke? Was this a joke? Were you guys like, what is this? A prank? And he ran down and he grabbed her and he goes, and then the husband was about to tell him off. He goes, leave us alone. You have no idea. She hasn't walked in 10 years. We don't know what to do. We don't know what's going on. And they're both just crying. He goes, you know the thing that shocked me the most about it, this bishop, he said? He just said, get up. They were the words, get up. Something so natural. Somebody so imbued with the power of God, he just says, get up, and the woman gets up. That's exactly what you're seeing here. Exactly what you're seeing with St. Paul. He looks intently. He sees somebody in need. Somehow he sees beyond it. And just through the power of God, says, get up. It's something that is very, very strange for us. But it's not something that exists just at the beginning of the church. It's something that existed until at least the 1960s. And even to this day. It's not common, but it happens, and it happens real. And so the man is healed. The people, we sometimes think, back then they used to believe anything. If someone, you know, is lying down for a while, they're sick for a month, they have a flu, then they get up, they say, oh, it's a miracle. And we say, no, it's actually a virus, it's self-limited, you get over it, whatever, okay? And we think they're just khalbanin, they're just weak people, they don't understand anything, you know, their minds were small, and that's why these things happened, and that's why they wrote down so many miracles. Well, actually, it's not true. They were just as shocked as us when things went against natural occurrences. There were not more miracles happening back then than we did. Sure, their medicine was much more limited than ours. But it doesn't mean that they weren't stupid. Because they would also see people with flu either getting better or not getting better. So it would have happened on a regular basis that people got better. In the same way we get better, naturally. Okay? So there's not, just because they're a bit more limited in their medical knowledge doesn't mean that they're stupid. It doesn't mean that they're daft. It doesn't mean that what they say shouldn't be taken as a credible witness. And one of the biggest proofs of that is look at the shock in the city when this person gets up and walks. In verse 11 to 13. Now when the people saw what Paul had done, they raised their voices, saying in the Lyconian language, "These gods, or the gods, have come down to us in the likeness of men." And Barnabas they called Zeus, and Paul Hermes, because he was the chief speaker. Then the priest of Zeus, whose temple was in front of their city, brought oxen and garlands to the gates, intending to sacrifice with the multitudes. So if this was a common occurrence, that randomly, you know, people that were lying down on the ground could get up and walk, why were they so shocked? They thought the gods had come among them. And on seeing it, they run and they worship Paul and Barnabas as gods in the flesh. Back then, you have to understand that also, especially with a lot of the Greek religions, the line between mortal, between a human being, and between God was sometimes thin. So that gods could sleep with women and have children. Hercules. All right? We all know about Hercules in the movies. All right? Very similar concept. Even St. Paul tells the Galatian community when he writes to them in Galatians, he says to them, "Don't you guys remember that you received me as an angel from God?" Okay? What does that mean? It could just mean that he's saying it's a messenger. It could mean something more. There's also irony in what happens here. The apostles are in a town. They were in a town. And they were persecuted, almost stoned, because they preached that God had come in the flesh. They go to another town, and people start worshipping them as gods in the flesh. So there's irony happening here. Then they call them Zeus and Hermes. Zeus was the most prominent member of the Olympian pantheon, so the most prominent god of Greek mythology. And Hermes was a chief speaker. So they sit there, and they see that Paul is this great speaker. They say, "He's Hermes." They look at Barnabas, they go, by association, by default, "You're Zeus." All right? We don't know why they called him Zeus. Why would they call him Zeus and Hermes? Was it just random? The Greeks had hundreds of gods. Why did they pick these two gods? There's actually a very strong reason why. There's a myth that was written by a guy called Ovid. He died in about 18 AD. The story probably came from a couple of hundred years before him. So before St. Paul. And the story was this. Zeus and Hermes came disguised as two people that needed to sleep somewhere that night. They couldn't find anywhere to sleep. They walk into the city and they knock at everyone's door. "Please, please, let us sleep. And there's nowhere for them to sleep. Eventually, they find this old couple. And the old couple think, "We're out of hospitality, we'll take care of them. We haven't got much, but we'll offer them what we have." The woman is pouring them wine. And these gods, they're drinking a bit, because Greek gods like to drink. All right? So they're drinking a bit, not like our god. So they're drinking a bit. All right? And then the wine isn't finishing. Every time she pours, there's more wine going into the glass. She pours, more wine goes into the glass. So she stops and goes, "Oh, the gods are here." And she recognizes them. She says, I don't know which gods you are, but you guys are gods. Please bless us. Please bless us. Okay? Her name was Baucis and her husband was Philemon. Okay? Because they responded so hospitably to these people, the gods say, "We will protect you guys. You guys will give you a head start. Leave the city. But we're going to destroy the rest of the city." And they send this great flood onto the earth. And that's one of the way that Greek mythology understood the great flood that happened, as we know, at the time of Noah. Okay? Different cultures had different... So if you look in different cultures and different religions, you'll find that almost all of them had this great flood story. Okay? Which is a very strong argument that actually did happen. Because they've all made it part of their religions. And so this is one of the ways they recognized it. The two gods that were there were Zeus and Hermes. Zeus and Hermes. Since then, there are instances where people every now and then freak out, "Could this be Zeus and Hermes?" Okay? Everybody was always on the watch for these two gods in disguise. Always on the watch. Now, these two guys come down, some guy's lying down on the ground, and they say, "Get up." And the guy gets up and walks. It's got to be Zeus and Hermes. We're not going to make that mistake again. We don't want a flood again. No, thank you. All right? And so they run and try to worship these people and say to them, "The gods have come down to us in the likeness of men. Zeus and Hermes are here in front of us. These are the gods. They're pretending. Let's not be stupid again." All right? But when the apostles Barnabas and Paul heard this, they tore their clothes, ran in among the multitude, crying out and saying, "Men, why are you doing these things? We also are men with the same nature as you, and we preach to you that you should turn from these useless things to the living God." Look at their response to the blasphemy. Look at the response to the blasphemy. Look how sudden and how dramatic it is. They run and tear their clothes, the classical sign of blasphemy. They run into the marketplace and say, no, you guys have got it wrong. How dare you worship us as gods? He is God. We are not gods. They can't stand even for a second that the glory goes to themselves and not God. Not even for a second. There's a very interesting story of Haile Selassie, the emperor of Ethiopia. He was a lovely guy. Pope Claudius loved him. And he did love the church. But I read something about him very interesting. Actually, he said it himself. After he was made king, his name before he was king was Rastafari. Okay? Rastafari. And so when he became king, he became Haile Selassie, the Lion of Judah, the King of Kings. He had this, like, you know, 16 different, you know, the titles after his name. And very quickly, the people of Jamaica, God knows why, started to worship him as God. Okay? They started to worship him as God. And so they kept inviting him when he became king, come and visit us in Jamaica. And so he went to Jamaica. When he landed in the airplane, they said about 100 or 200,000 people gathered around the plane. Everybody was smoking up weed, all right? And he goes, the smell of ganja filled up the air, okay? So that everywhere you went, you just smelt marijuana, all right? Because this was the king, all right? The king had come. This is how we welcome my king, by getting high. And he goes, and he refused to get out of the plane because he thought, what is this? What is this? This is crazy. So he refused to get out of the plane until eventually somebody calmed him down and said, no, come out. He stayed there for however long his trip was. He didn't once, to the shock of the Jamaican authorities, deny that he was God. They asked him about it later on in 1968. So he visited in 1966. Why didn't you tell them that you weren't God? Because he was actually a very religious and devout Ethiopian Orthodox Christian. He said, why didn't you deny it? He said, I didn't want to disturb their faith. I didn't want to disturb their beliefs and, you know, make them upset. Because of that, till this day, the Rastafarians that believed in Rastafari, Haile Selassie, refused to accept that he ever denied that he was Christ. And if you read what they write, almost always they say the same thing. He did not deny that he was Christ when he was in Jamaica. I'm not saying this was a mistake. You can't judge the guy, he's dead. But all I can maybe say is, look at the result. He didn't want to disturb them. He might have had the best of intentions. But by him not straight away saying, the glory is not mine, the glory is God's, he has created the religion in Jamaica. That religion might have persisted, but at least it wasn't on him. Maybe that is why St. Paul and St. Barnabas ran so quickly. They didn't say, no, guys, just calm down. We'll meet next week. We'll have a chat about it. We'll discuss your faith. We'll discuss your beliefs and we'll fix it a little bit and say, we're not really God, but he's God, but it's right. It's okay for now. We're starting all right. They didn't do that. Why? Because people believe whatever you want to tell them. If you give people one micromillimeter, they will literally take 15 kilometers in their faith. Okay? So they're very, very strong to say straight away, no, we are not gods. We're the messengers of the one God. St. John Chrysostom says, notice the vehemence with which all of this was done by the apostles. They tore their garments and rushed out among the multitude crying, all because their very beings were turning away in horror from what had happened. They were in horror that they could somehow be given the glory of God. They were in horror. For truly it was grief, a grief inconsolable. They were about to be called gods and so introduce idolatry, the very thing that they had come to destroy. Very powerful words. Very powerful words. And then St. Paul gives this beautiful speech in verse 15 to 18. And saying, men, why are you doing these things? We also are men with the very same nature as you, and preach to you that you should turn from these useless things to the living God, who made the heaven, the earth, the sea, and all things that are in them, who in bygone generations allowed all nations to walk in their own ways. Nevertheless, he did not leave himself without witness in that he did good, gave us rain from heaven and fruitful seasons, filling our hearts with food and gladness. And so now he gives a very different speech to what we heard in the last chapter. Do you guys remember the speech he gave in the last chapter? In the synagogue? Where he's talking about the Old Testament, he's talking about the prophets, he's talking about what God has done in the past for Israel. Now, does he have any Bible quotations in there? Does he quote from any Psalms in there? Why? because they're Gentiles. He is a master speaker. He knows exactly what he is doing. When he speaks to the Jews, he speaks to them from their world. When he comes to the Gentiles, to the Greeks, he speaks to them from their world. If I'm speaking to somebody that has never heard of the Old Testament, am I going to think, guys, don't you remember what happened in Psalm 2? Psalm 23, remember that? I remember that. Isaiah 53, you don't remember Isaiah 53? Okay. No, you don't do that. They've got no idea what he's talking about. So he talks into the language that they have. So he says to them, first of all, common ground. I'm a human, just like you guys are human. I'm a human, just like you guys are human. Verse 16, he says to them, who in bygone generations allowed all nations to walk in their own ways. So he doesn't come to them saying, guys, I'm going to judge you guys. You guys are evil. You guys are pagans. You guys have done this. You guys have done that. Some of you have two wives. He doesn't do that. He says, no. No judgment. God allowed the nations to walk in their own ways for a while, but he did not leave himself without some witness, in that he did good, gave us rain from heaven and fruitful seasons, filling our hearts with food and gladness. So he's telling them, what do you know? What does a Gentile person living in a village, in Lycaonia, Lystra, Derbe, small little places, agricultural fields, what kind of work do they do? What kind of work do they do? Farmers. So he talks from agriculture. If I'm a farmer, what is the one thing I'm obsessed with? What is the thing one Australian farmers are obsessed with? Rain. Season. What is the thing that Egyptians are obsessed with? What do we pray for during Pascha, during our liturgies? That the Nile ever floods. One of the most famous sayings of the Desert Fathers is, the Nile would not flood had it not been for the prayer of this Desert Father. Okay? It's how they lived. They lived by the seasons. And it's the same Paul says to them, you're living by the seasons. You're used to this agricultural rhythm. You attribute the blessing of the crops to the gods. Do you not see that that is all pointing to the one God? When you sit there in the choir and you see the beauty of the world, when you see the beauty of nature, when you see how everything interconnects, that moves you. It's something that some of the Catholic scholastic scholars, even though some of the stuff they're saying wasn't exactly perfect, were saying that it's a natural law. Nature itself gives evidence. Nature itself gives evidence. One of the sayings is something like, God puts in scripture, puts in the lives of the saints, puts in our theology, things in little small writing, so those people that can't, in big writing, so those people that can't see the small writing on the earth, can't see the small writing in the rocks, in the ocean, in the rivers, and all these other things. So he's arguing that even from nature, and he'll do that much stronger in a couple of his epistles, say that nature itself indicates, reveals, points towards God. Okay. So all I want you guys to take from that is, you see, he's a master of mission. He knows what he's doing. He knows how to talk to people. He doesn't go out and talk to a bunch of scholars in the language of a two-year-old primary school, Sunday school lesson. He doesn't go talk to a bunch of six-year-old kids in the languages of Aristotle and Plato and whoever else. He talks to people in the way that they can understand him. He communicates the same gospel in two different ways. In two different ways. Something very important for us to realize. But then in verse 18, what's the result? And with these sayings, they could scarcely restrain the multitudes of sacrificing to him. He just gave them a speech. He just said, I'm not God. I'm a human being like you guys. I just tore my clothes. Like my naked hairy chest is sticking out. What else do you guys want from me? What do you guys don't want from me? It seems that they thought the gods were still persisting in their disguise. Also, St. Paul probably gave a very powerful speech. He was a very powerful speaker. They must have experienced the authority of his word. And so they thought, no, he's still Hermes. He's still Hermes. He's faking. We'll still sacrifice. And then he goes, then Jews, in verse 19 to 20, then Jews from Antioch and Iconium, remember, they were originally preaching in Pisidian Antioch. They were originally preaching in Iconium. They followed them. And they came there. Having persuaded the multitudes, they stoned Paul and dragged him out of the city, supposing him to be dead. However, when the disciples gathered around him, he rose up and went into the city. And the next day he departed with Barnabas to Derbe. So they followed them. Pisidian Antioch was about 4 to 5 days' travel away. Iconium was probably only about a day away. So now look at this. The same crowds that were about to sacrifice to St. Paul and Barnabas now want to sacrifice St. Paul and Barnabas. The same crowds that had brought lambs and were about to kill animals and say, you are gods, now turned on and said, no, we're going to kill you. We're going to kill you and act towards you in a way that we wouldn't act even to human beings next to us. Doesn't make sense. Doesn't make sense. St. Luke is playing up and making very clear just how fickle these crowds are. Just how fickle these crowds are. Why? Because that is the response of early faith. That is the response of early faith. Unless it is watered, unless it is protected, unless it is guarded, unless it is nourished, unless it is sustained, it will fall away. It will fall away. Which is why feelings mean rubbish. Feelings mean rubbish. Feelings are good in as much as they move us towards God, but that's where they end. Some of the saints would refuse to pray. I can't remember who it is. I wish I could remember. I can't remember. He said that I was praying, and as I was praying, I smelt a sweet aroma. I closed the Bible and said, I'm not praying anymore, God, until you take away the smell away. He said, I don't want it. I don't need it. I'm happy to pray quietly, silently, just focused on you. Something remarkable. We get a smell. Ooh, can you smell that? Can you smell that? I'm a saint. Right? I'm a saint. Okay.
Just on that point, I'm not sure that I said once, about a month, I think he was talking about himself praying in the desert, and he was accompanied by angels. He said he wouldn't turn around to be the angels because he'd be distracted from the high purpose.
Yeah, sure, sure. Because all of these things, they're movements towards faith. But if we focus just on that movement, just on that initial change, just on that initial feeling, it'll take me nowhere. It'll take me nowhere. It's why we ourselves change every 2 seconds and fall every 2 seconds. Okay? Change in order to be concrete, repentance, reconfiguration, moving towards God to be concrete, is much more than just feeling, is much more than just emotion, just more than a couple of tears falling down my cheeks. It needs power behind it. It needs discipline behind it. It needs rigor behind it. That's why the church will say, you need a canon of prayer. You need to have a rule of prayer. Because the day will come, probably within about 2 or 3 days, the feeling will disappear. The lollipop goes away. The lollipop goes away. God, well, I can give my little son a lollipop to get him to listen to me and eat his dinner. I can do it once. I can do it twice. I can do it a week. I can do it 3 weeks. But eventually, he's going to become so addicted to the lollipop, he won't even eat his dinner. And he'll tantrum every 2 seconds unless he gets that lollipop. And that's exactly what we do. That's exactly what we do. So it's very, very important we pay attention to just how fickle the crowds are, because that crowd is us. And that's what we do day in, day out. And they stone him, and supposing him to be dead. And then it says, however, when the disciples gathered around him. Now remember, we are where? Where in the world are we? Lystra. Who are the disciples that are around him? Did St. Peter catch a flight? Who are the disciples around him? Anyone? I'll give you Barnabas. But I didn't say disciples, I said disciples. Anyone? Yeah?
Could have been Seattle, those two groups, and I said before, maybe one of the groups came. Or like Seattle. Seattle, those two groups, one group that's Barnabas, then two groups, one group that's Seattle.
Yeah, so as in people that converted from those communities? Yeah, beautiful. That's most likely who it was. So we think that this all happened within 1 day, 2 days, 3 days. But St. Paul is very, very clear, or St. Luke, sorry, is very, very clear, that he preached there a long time. So we don't know how long he was in these places. He could have been months. Okay, he was certainly long enough for them, for him to have disciples gathering around him. And then notice what happens. He's stoned. He's obviously that badly injured that they think he's dead and they throw him outside the city. All right, he's not faking. He's obviously pretty badly injured. I mean, I've never been stoned, but I can't be pleasant having rocks thrown at my head. All right, and if I'm kind of in a state of unconsciousness, it's pretty bad. It's pretty bad. What does it say? However, when the disciples gathered around him, he rose up and went into the city. That's pretty crazy. He gets up. Not only does he get up from being stoned, it doesn't go, guys, I need a month off preaching. I need some time to recuperate. I'm just going to go hang out in Jerusalem again, have some lady bring me some food and some stuff and some wine and just relax a bit, give me a massage. Then I'll be ready to go back to preaching. He gets up that day and goes back into the same city that just stoned him. It's crazy. It's crazy. One, mob action, because this is a mob action, easily dies down. Okay, mob action is very, very fickle. You'll find that one leader gets a bit hot-headed, he starts a mob movement. It's easy, it easily dies down. So likely, when he went back into the city, things had chilled. Two, they thought he was dead, so they weren't exactly looking for him in the city. Three, those who had converted... Sorry, I don't know what I've written there. Oh yeah, those who had converted, the people that had been in Lystra, that had come and accepted Christ, if they thought St. Paul was dead, what would happen to them? Strike the shepherd and the sheep are scattered. So he was obviously concerned for his people. So he needs to go back into them and say, guys, relax, I'm still alive, it's all good, Christ took care of me, I'm here. Four, where is he going to lodge in the middle of the night in Lystra, in the middle of the place where he's going to have to walk at least 2 days to get to the next city? Where's he going to sleep? He's obviously badly injured. He needs to be tended to. So he goes back to the city, somewhere he can have a rest. All right. But do you get the sense that he's a bit of a ragan? He's a bit of a man? Like, he's tough? Right? He doesn't think about himself. He doesn't care about himself. He doesn't care that he's probably got cuts on his body. He's probably injured. He's probably got some quite severe bruising. His eyes probably closed over because of the bruising. He doesn't care. He's got a job. He's got a mission. His mission is Christ. He doesn't care about anything else. No matter what comes in his way, he will not stop. When St. Paul says, you have not yet struggled against sin to bloodshed, he says that because he himself has done that. He has struggled for Christ even till bloodshed, and it doesn't stop him. It reminds me of a guy that's still alive. I think he's a Greek priest, Luke Veronis, Father Luke Veronis. He was a missionary, and he just was recently married, and God gave him a beautiful wife that was willing to follow him no matter where he went. And so he went to Albania. And when he went to Albania, at the time, the place was broken because of the wars and those kind of things, and he started preaching. And he started the church there, and he was working. And he had a really, really tough time. There wasn't that many Christians there in terms of where he was preaching. And he goes, one morning, I woke up, and I had about $3,000 in my pocket. It's all the money I had. And I was going to pay for somebody's plane ticket for a missionary to come into the country. And then they were going to pay me back later on. But it's all the money I had, me and my wife had. Because as I was walking, I got robbed. As I got robbed, within about 10 minutes, I got a phone call that my house was on fire with the only possessions that I owned. And he's writing this himself. He's a very honest guy. He's still alive. He goes, so I rushed back to the house and I found all of our possessions, all that we had, on fire. His wife at the time had just fallen pregnant after years of trying to fall pregnant. When she heard the news of the fire, she had a miscarriage. Whether or not it was related to the stress, who knows? Whether it was coincidental, who knows? Within 2 days, he lost his savings. He lost his house with all his possessions. He lost his only child that they've been struggling for years. When I read that, as he was writing this, I thought, halas, you've got every excuse in the world. Pick up your bags, whatever burnt bag you've got left. Get in a plane, go home, forget about this missionary man. God's not taking care of you. He doesn't want you to be there. Go serve somewhere else. He goes, I grabbed my wife, I hugged her, and I said, Malish, it's okay. It's okay. We'll continue. We'll continue. And I thought, St. Paul, this guy's a rakel. This guy's strong. This guy's tough. This guy's not sitting there worrying about the money, worrying about the house. Of course it hurts. Of course it's painful. Anyone that's been trying for a child knows that it hurts not to have a child. And to have that taken from you, have your house with your only possessions, to have nothing left in the world after you've already sacrificed everything for God, and even have that stripped away from you. But Raga, his eyes are focused on the kingdom. His eyes aren't focused on what's on the ground. He doesn't care about his own comfort. He cares about the kingdom. It's all he cares about. It's all he wants. It's all he desires. Within a couple of years of that, he was able to, I think he had 3 children. He wasn't able to have children for years, and then all of a sudden was able to have successive children. And he was blessed. And the mission that he did there is the most authentic, the most powerful, the most successful Orthodox mission throughout the world. Because of him and the Archbishop that are there. Why? Why? Because these guys have their eyes in the kingdom. Their eyes in the kingdom. They don't care about the things on the ground. They don't care about themselves. I know that he's so hard, and I can't say that I'd come even close to doing it. But it's something at least that we should stop and say, this is what I should be trying to do even a little bit. Even a little bit. My car breaks down. Don't cry about it. Move on. I lose a toenail. Don't worry about it. It's going to come back. A girl says no to me when I ask her out. Malesh, get over it. Another girl will come. Keep your focus on the kingdom. Keep your focus on the things that are important. I start a service. No one comes to the meeting I start. No one. I do it for 6 months. No one comes. God doesn't want me to do it. No, be strong. Be strong. I start in Sunday school. None of my kids care about anything I'm saying. I've tried everything. I tried PowerPoint. I tried Prezi. I tried just talking. I tried getting YouTube. I tried everything. I tried to get into soccer. No one. They don't come. They don't care. They don't listen to me. Have some toughness. Have some zeal. Be strong about what you're doing. Your focus is the kingdom. It is up to God to bless. It is up to God to take care of our personal happiness. It is up to God to take care of our external circumstances. Let's be tough. If I can't be tough in giving my life, let me be tough in the little things in life. Let me be tough in the way I walk. Let me be tough in the way that I worship God. Let me be tough in that, okay, I get a little bit sick. Who cares? Let me continue praying. Let me be tough in the way that, I lost my job. So what? Why lose my faith in God? Why lose my faith in God? Let's have our eyes focused on the kingdom. St. John Chrysostom says, "Believe me, it is possible to suffer things now worse than what St. Paul suffered. Those enemies pelted him with stones, but it is now possible to pelt with words that are worse than stones. What then must one do? The same that he did. He did not hate those who cast the stones. After they dragged him out, he entered their city again to be a benefactor, to give them benefits to those who had done him such wrongs. He entered the city. Do you see his zeal? Do you see how fervent he is? How set on fire? How set on fire? We need to be like him. We need to be like him. We need to stop thinking that I'm just the guy that sits there in the back of church and it's all good. You know, I just come on Sunday. I'll come to a Bible study on Monday night. I'll come listen. I'll sit quietly. I won't look at my phone during that hour, and that's enough. No. We're all called to be saints. We're all called to be Christians. And I know I've told you guys this story before, but I'll tell you anyway, because it was something that really struck me really, really deep, and still does, that there's a very holy bishop who's the Bishop of St. Anthony's Monastery, Ambiostos. He'll come to Sydney every couple of years, and when he does, he's too holy, right? He does all his weird stuff, and he looks you in the eye, and he freaks you out. So once he was sitting there, and I don't know if it was probably coincidental, because who's God to tell me anything? But I was sitting there, and I happened to be sitting directly in front of him, which I shouldn't have done. And in retrospect, I'll never do again. And he was saying this story. It's a very famous story about some people that gave these kids a soccer ball that was a bomb. And the kids played the soccer ball, and then two brothers died. Okay, and so the priests went to the mother of these two children and said to them, "I'm so sorry. I don't have words to say to you. I don't have words to say to you." And the woman said to them, "Better that I lose my two sons than that one of you loses a fingernail." And then Ambiostos stopped. As he was saying this, looked at me, because I was directly in his path, not because of anything special. Looked me directly in the heart and said, "Ana Mesh Masihi, Ana Mesh Masihi, Ana Mesh Masihi. We are not Christians. We are not Christians. We are not Christians." While he's staring at me, "We are not Christians." He said it like 10, 15 times. I'm like, "All right, just look over there, man." Like, "All right, I got it after the third time. All right, I know I'm not a Christian." But he was saying this as a bishop who's an extremely holy bishop. He kept saying, "We are not Christians. We are not Christians." Because he felt that really, if we're Christians, it's not about a name. It's not about my denomination. It's about the fact that I'm a follower of Christ. And if I'm a follower of Christ, I follow him in everything. I follow him with this toughness, with this zeal. I'm set on fire for him. That means there's no such thing as a Christian in the back of the church or a Christian at the front of the church. There's no such thing between a Christian on the first level of the church and a Christian on the bottom level of the church. There's no such thing. Each one is called to be a member of Christ in the same capacity as the one next to him. We are all called to be saints. We're all called to live as saints. We can't keep living on the fence. We can't keep sitting there saying, "Yeah, but I'm just a guy that works, I'm a teacher, you know, God doesn't expect a great deal from me. Oh, I wasn't given that much intelligence. I wasn't given that much good looks. I wasn't given that much hair. I'll just, you know, God doesn't want that much from me. He's happy for me just to, you know, mind my own business, go to church. What does God need from me?" No. No. He needs more. He needs more. So then we come to verses 21 to 22. And when they had preached the gospel to that city and made many disciples, they returned to Lystra, Iconium, and Antioch, strengthening the souls of the disciples, exhorting them to continue in the faith and saying, we must through many tribulations enter the kingdom of God. So after preaching in Derbe, they then go to Lystra, where he was stoned, Iconium, where he's rejected, Pisidian Antioch, where he's rejected. He cycles back through the same places that rejected him. The guy's got toughness. But it says this time, but there were many disciples there. There were many disciples there. What does that mean? It means that this mission that we think is useless. He gets rejected and kicked out of a city, shakes up his garments, runs off to another city. And we think, oh, that wasn't too successful. Even where he is going, he is being successful. No matter what he is doing, he is being successful. He may not see it himself. He might have left that city thinking, man, we didn't even get one convert in that whole city. And then he comes back and all of a sudden there's 100. Because his example, his martyria, his witness is enough to convert people. That's why when we call a saint a martyr, somebody that sheds their blood for Christ, we don't call them a sufferer. We don't call them a co-sufferer of Christ. We don't call them the crucified. We call them martyrs. We call them literally in that Greek word, which means witnesses to Christ. Because they, in their deaths, prove Christ. They prove the resurrection, St. Athanasius says. They are the greatest proof of the resurrection. And so he cycles through, sometimes in person, sometimes in letter, sometimes in messengers. And he does this continually throughout his mission. He starts a mission, 2 weeks later goes through it, 3 months later goes through it, 6 years later goes through it. He constantly cycles through. He plants, he waters, he tenders, he prunes. That is how mission should be done. That is how mission should be done. That is how mission should be done on a very basic level in my Sunday school class, or among my friends, or among my family. I bring up the topic. They don't like it. That's right. I won't mention it again for a little bit. Give it a week. Bring it up again. Doesn't work. I bring it up in a different kind of way. Kind of works. Invite them to church. Then they go away. They're not really interested. Invite them to church again. Keep trying. Keep trying. Keep trying. Keep trying. Keep trying. Keep trying. They'll break. They'll break. People can't stand that kind of love. People can't stand that kind of person that is interested in them. When you have a successful service, whether that's a mission, whether that's a Sunday school class, whether that's a meeting, whatever it is, whatever you do in your life, don't ignore it. Don't just sit there and go, it'll function. That is the mistake of so much of what we have done. That we start things without finishing things. We start things and then we send them priests that can't even speak English, or can't speak Thai, or can't speak French, or whatever it is. And so there's no nourishing, there's no sustaining, there's no growth. St. Paul literally says he strengthens the souls there. Converts are zealous, but they are also fickle. Their roots are very, very shallow. They need to be deepened. They need to have someone constantly sitting there watering them, constantly changing the soil on the top, constantly putting the mulch around, constantly putting weed killer. Sorry, I'm doing a lot of stuff in my garden right now. Constantly taking care, constantly plucking out the weeds. Or else the weeds grow back, the plant dies. And so it says then in verse 23, he does something very interesting. So when they had appointed elders in every church and prayed with fasting, they commended them to the Lord in whom they believed. So it says they appointed elders. The word for elders in Greek is presbyteros, presbyters, priests. All right, they're considered to be the leaders of the community. And he anoints them to every church. That word for church that you get there is ecclesia. That's the word that the Hebrew word kahal used to mean. And the reason why I'm making a point about that is because the way we understand church is walls. But that is not the way the church is ever understood. It's not the way the earliest church understood itself. It's not the way that Judaism understood itself as a church, as the kahal. What they understand is that they are the people of God that have been assembled by God, for God, in God. Okay? And then St. Paul says he commends them after prayer, after fasting, after appointing priests for them, to the Lord. It doesn't say he commended them to himself, so that he named every church St. Paul and St. Patrick's in Derby, St. Paul and St. Mary's in Lystra. St. Paul, no, he doesn't do that. He doesn't commend them to himself, When St. Paul does mission, he doesn't muck around. He creates a church that is not dependent on him. He nourishes it. He takes care of it as a father. He says, I've labored in birth to give birth to you till Christ is formed in you. Okay? But he doesn't do it so they point to him. He doesn't do it so they're stuck on him. He doesn't do it so they're linked to him. In fact, in 1 Corinthians, he says to them, this is your problem. I hear that there are some among you who are saying, I'm of Paul. And then another group is saying that I'm of Peter. And others are saying that I'm of Apollo. And some people even say, I'm of Christ. Because you guys don't realize how stupid you are? Do you not realize how stupid you are? Was St. Paul crucified for you? Did I die on the cross for you? Were you baptized into St. Paul's death? No. No. So he's saying to them this concept that when we serve, when we do mission, when we serve in our families, when we serve in our Sunday school, when we serve in our churches, we don't do that for the purpose of bringing people to us. I don't have a Sunday school class and I make them addicted to me. They can't survive without me. They can't function without me. So that the year after, when the class goes down a bit and the other Sunday school servant has it, I don't say it, but I feel in my heart, yeah, that's because I wasn't there. All right? Whether I admit it or not, it's there. It's there. Why? Why? Why is it that when I leave a service, the service dies? Not me personally. When I leave a service, the service dies. I didn't commend them to Christ. I commended them to myself. So when I die, they die. St. Paul doesn't do it like that. Doesn't do it like that. I remember once I heard somebody when Pope Shenouda died, God rest his soul, when he died, I heard someone say, that's the end of the church. And I remember Abuna Mark was with me and he said, grow up. Because it's stupid. What you're saying is stupid. If that's the case, we don't believe in Christ, we believe in Pope Shenouda. Pope Shenouda is an incredible saint, an incredible man, but he's not Christ. His job was to take us to Christ. That's the whole mission of these people, that they create links, not to themselves, but to Christ. One of the reasons why, for instance, Pope Carolus very rarely, if ever, gave a talk, ever gave a sermon, would entrust people to do that in his place, ordained bishops that he disagreed with at certain times and knew he was going to disagree with in certain times in his place to give talks, would make bishops in the place of bishops of education, bishops of scientific education, bishops of ecumenicism and all these other things instead of himself, even though he was very, very capable, was very trained theologically. Why? So that the link would not be to him, so that the church could stand on its own feet with or without him. Alright. So St. Paul does not muck around. He commends them to Christ. And then they come verse 24 to 28. And after they had passed through Pisidia, they came to Pamphylia. Now when they had preached the word in Perga, they went down to Attalia. From there they sailed to Antioch. This is Syrian Antioch, where they first started out right at the beginning, where they had been commended to the grace of God for the work which they completed. Now when they had come and gathered the church together in Syrian Antioch, they reported all that God had done with them and that he had opened the door of faith to the Gentiles. So they stayed there with a long time with the disciples. So notice, even on their way back, they have to restock, they have to resupply, they have to reconnect, whatever they have to do, they run out of funds, who knows. On their way back, everywhere they go, they preach. Everywhere they go, they preach. They don't go one step without preaching. They land in a city, they preach there. They walk, they preach there. They walk to buy some groceries, they preach there. It's what Saint Francis of Assisi says, a Catholic saint. He says, whenever you walk into a marketplace, preach Christ. And when you have to, if you absolutely need to, use a couple of words. Use a couple of words. So preaching is not so much the words. It's the fact that no matter where I go, no matter what city I go, no matter what school I go into, no matter what university I go, no matter what work I do, no matter what petrol station I walk into, preach. I was recently talking to Abuna Pablo Hanna, one of the priests at Blacktown, and he was telling me that every time he goes on holiday, generally, he goes to Nelson's Bay. Every time he takes like a Sunday school group or someone away, he'll take him to Nelson's Bay. He goes, I always use the same jet ski guy. Not that priests are out the jet ski. But if we did, we'd wear a galabeya. All right? Because every time I use the same jet ski guy. After 3-4 years, the guy said to me, look, I've got 2 children. He's a Greek guy. Because I never had them baptized. There's not really a good church around me. Do you mind if I bring them to you in Blacktown to get them baptized? He's going to go from Newcastle all the way down to Blacktown to get the kids baptized? He goes, of course, welcome. He goes, within weeks, he had sent dozens of his family members that lived around the Western Sydney to come and get baptized. What did he do? I go, what'd you do? What'd you say to the guy? He goes, nothing. I was nice to him. I acted like a Christian with him. Exactly what St. Francis of Assisi says. Wherever you go, preach Christ. Don't think to yourself, okay, on the 2nd of January, I'm going to sit there, I'm going to have a meeting, I'm going to go and preach. On the 9th of May, I'm going to call up my friend, I'm going to invite him to church. No. In your behavior, daily, in every second, think to yourself, I am preaching Christ. My behavior preaches him. Another story I think I've told you guys. I was once at work, when I was working before, and I was talking to a lady, and she was middle-aged, or I don't know, 30, 40, or something like that. That's not middle-aged, is it? 40. She was 40. Let's make her a bit older for the older people in the room. And she was sitting there, and she said to me, so you said you're going to church? Because I had the week off for Passion Week. I said, yeah. She goes, do you know this person? And I said, yeah, I do. She goes, he is the greatest human being I've ever seen in my life. I said, that's pretty big words. She goes, I'm not joking. He is the greatest human being I have ever seen in my life. The most beautiful human being. So I thought she must have had a crush on him. They went to uni together. She might have been in love with him. It was unrequited love or something. It had to be something like that. You know, women, they crush on men very easily. And so I thought that had to be it. That had to be it. So then I went and asked him, do you remember this lady? He goes, nah. I go, and I showed him a photo. I go, do you remember her? He goes, oh, she was in one of my classes. I don't think I ever had a conversation with her. Can you believe it? Can you believe it? Yet she, from just attending the same classroom as this guy, thought that he was the greatest human being that she'd ever met in his life, in her life. Can you imagine that effect if all of us were like that? Can you imagine that effect? And that's what we're called to be. That's what we're called to be. And then when they finally arrive, they say they reported what God had done with them. They did not report what I had done. They did not report what Barnabas had done. They did not report what St. Paul had done. They reported what God had done in them. They didn't say that they reported what God had done. They reported what God had done in them. They're real. Humility is not about lying. Humility is about truth, but recognizing that glory is God's. Knowing, yes, I was part of that mission. But the only reason anything happened in that mission was that God did the work in me. And that's exactly what St. Paul says. By God's grace, I am what I am. So, I hope what's coming out of these chapters is you see the way, obviously St. Paul's getting the glory a bit relative to St. Barnabas, all right? Because he's obviously the number one, the chief speaker. But we're not seeing Barnabas, that Barnabas is supporting him in every step. That Barnabas is getting his own glory. Throughout these chapters, time and time again, you're seeing this spirit of somebody that is dedicated to Christ. Somebody that is wholeheartedly consecrated to Christ. Not in a formal ordination. Not because he's wearing black. But because he feels that my heart truly is Christ's. And that means everything I do is his. Every effort, every word, every thought. St. Paul says, I bring every thought into captivity to Christ. Everything I do, every step, every fiber of my body is dedicated to him. That means if they strike me down, I don't care, I'll move on to the next city. If they stone me, I'll go back into that same city. I don't care. I don't care. I don't have fear. My life is Christ and Christ alone. St. John Chrysostom, well, I probably won't get a chance to say this, I'll say it now. At the end of his commentary on Romans, he sits there and he gives this unbelievable, if you ever get a chance to look it up, you can find it on the internet. He gives a sermon, a homily, just talking about St. Paul. He says, before I end, I just have to talk to you about this guy. I'm amazed by him. I'm amazed by him. And then he gives this homily. In the homily, every sentence he says about St. Paul, he's using a sentence from St. Paul. So for example, he says, this great man who could not think a thought unless that thought came from Christ because he brought every thought into captivity to Christ. Every single thing he talks about, his personality, his movements, the way he thought, the way he acted, he's quoting St. Paul back at him. For him, St. Paul was not living and preaching something that he wasn't. Everything he did, every thought, every theology, every word, every preaching, every action, every act of behavior was secondary to the way he was, to the life that he was living, to the Christ that was formed, that was breathing, that was acting, that was being crucified daily in him. We're not St. Paul. We're not St. Paul, but we're Christians. And we're called to be like him, to at least strive to be like him. I say that to myself first, because it's painful when you read his life. It is painful. It is convicting. When you read these words, you're like, what is wrong with me? Why can't I be like that? But that's a good thing. The problem is not that you're sitting there thinking, why can't I be like that? The problem is that we're sitting there thinking that we have nothing to do with this. This is somebody else's problem. Preaching is somebody else's problem. Being a Christian is somebody else's problem. Being a saint is somebody else's problem. It's all of our problems. It's all of our problems. Like I said, Christ polarizes. Miracles, the acting of God on earth, polarizes. We can't keep sitting in the fence. I can't keep sitting in the middle of the aisle. I need to pick a side. Which side's the good side? I don't know. That side. But we've got a tech check. We have to think about what we're doing. We really have to think about what we're doing. And I say that to myself first, because it's enough. Enough's enough. Enough's enough. Let's take the last couple of weeks of Lent. Let's take it very, very seriously. Let's move. Let's be like Saint John Chrysostom said. Let's be set on fire. Let's stop being satisfied with chabad and stupidity and rubbish and stuff that is wasting me and Facebook. I hate Facebook so badly. All right? And all this other stuff that is just distracting me, taking me away from God. Let's do something. Do something radical. Do something radical. If you don't have an opportunity, go and speak to somebody tomorrow. Put yourself in the mind of the earliest church, that Christ's kingdom was here to be spread on the earth, that the world was to be set on fire. We didn't have an option. They didn't have an option. Everybody took that command extremely seriously, and the world was set on fire. Until eventually the people that were supposed to be setting the world on fire, their own candles went out, and they forgot their mission. And then St. Paul, everything that he says against the Jews and Romans, he could say just as accurately towards us today. All right? So let's move. Let's beg God that he has mercy on us. Let's beg God that he has mercy on me, please. And next week we'll see you guys for Acts 15, which will be the last chapter before. I'm not sure who's doing the next series. So thanks be to God. Glory be to him. Any questions at all? I know I won't be long today, so you don't have to ask questions if you don't want to. No? Awesome. Thank you.
Can we please stand up for prayer?